Chapter 22. That evening, Heruhark had still not returned. Gideon busied herself with catching up on her training exercises, frustrated by her sore muscles, which wanted to pack it in after the first 100 push-ups. She spent a long time doing her solo drills, the automatic litany of grip and guard, flexing into hand positions while staring out the window into the drooping black night. And then, pretty certain that Hero wasn't returning, she got out her longsword and did it all again. Having two hands on the grip was precisely the thing that Iglamine had told her not to do, but it felt so good that by the end she was happy as a child. Hero never came back. Gideon was used to this by now. Seized with sudden experimental courage, she filled up the uncanny tub in the bathroom from the hot liquid tap. When nothing jumped out at her, Gideon sat there in it with water all the way up to her chin. It was incredible. The strangest thing she had ever felt in her life. Like being buoyed on a warm current, like being slowly boiled. And she worried, irrationally, whether water could get inside you and make you sick. All her paint came off and floated in long, dirty flecks in the water. When she put soap in the water, oily rainbow slicks shone across the top. In the end, suspicious of how clean it really got you, she went and stood in the sonic for 20 seconds, but she smelled incredible. When her hair dried, it stood up on end, and it took a lot of effort to get it flat again. The bath was soporific. For the first time since she'd come to Canaan House, Gideon was truly content to lie down in her nest, get out a magazine and do absolutely nothing for half an hour. 9 dreamless hours later, she woke up with the pages stuck to her face via a thin sealant of drool. She said, peeling it off her face, and, Hero? As it turned out, in the next room, Hero was curled up in bed with the pillows over her head and her arms sticking out. Haphazardly flung laundry was piled next to the wardrobe door. The sight filled Gideon with a sensation that she had to admit was relief. She said, Wake up, ass munch! I want to yell at you about keys! But this imperative did not have the desired effect. The white key is now with your precious Septimus, as per the agreement, snapped Hera, then pulled the covers over her head. Now go away and shrivel! This does not satisfy me, Nonagesimus! Hera slithered more deeply underneath the covers like a bad black snake and refused to get up. It was hopeless pushing further. This freed Gideon to dress in relative peace and quiet, paint without critique, and leave their quarters feeling unusual amounts of peace with the world. She realised she was being followed somewhere down the long, sweeping staircase that led to the atrium, a peripheral blur huddled in doorways, still when she was still, making tiny movements when she was in motion. The mouldering floorboards creaked wetly underfoot. At last, Gideon spun around, her rapier drawn in one long fluid line forward and her gauntlet already half snapped onto her fingers, and was presented with the wild young face of Isaac.
Stop, he said. Sean wants you.
He looked ghastly. His hands were sooty, the metallic thread on his embroidered robe soiled, and somewhere along the way he'd lost at least 3 earrings. Previously, he had contrived to brush his hair up in that bleached avian crest on the top of his head, but now everything was crumpled flat. His mouth and eyes seemed emptied out, and his pupils were dilated with an amount of cortisol that said,
I've been on edge for 3 days.
The sweet puppy fat at his cheeks only served to make him a more awful sight. Gideon cocked her head.
Sean wants you, he repeated. Someone's dead. You've got to come with me.
For a moment, Gideon hoped that this was a terrifically misplaced cry for attention, but Isaac had already turned away from her, dark eyes like stones. She had no choice but to follow in his wake. Isaac led her down through the dilapidated great hall and then down the stairs to the vestibule that led through to the sparring room, and he flinched at the sight of every white-belted skeleton that crossed their path. The tapestry was still securely in place, the door still hidden. He shouldered through the other door. It must have given his elbow a hell of a bang, and pushed into the room where electric lights poured down on what had previously been a filthy, reeking pit. It was now a square of glimmering water. Gideon had seen skeletons unrolling great tracts of rubber hose into the pit room, and even beheld them slowly glurking sea-smelling liquid into the cavity. But the end result was extraordinary. The tiles gleamed with spray as Nibirius III and Coronabeth, both wearing light singlets and trunks, did laps up and down the pool. If she'd thought the bath was mad, this blew her mind. Gideon had never seen anyone swim before. Both bodies cut through the liquid with efficient, practiced strokes. She focused on the long, golden arms of Corona Tridentarius as she sliced through the water, propelling her as she hit the wall and pushed off hard with her feet. Beyond the glass doors in the sparring room, Colum the Eighth sat on a bench, polishing his targe with a soft cloth, while Lieutenant Dias knelt into a perfect lunge over and over. Isaac made a beeline for the water. He stood in front of where the Crown Princess of Ida was churning her way through the water. She slowed her pace and bobbed up to the edge of the pool, shaking water out of her ears quizzically, hair a wet and leaden amber.
"Princess Corona," he said, "someone's dead."
The lovely face of the Princess of Ida made the exact same expression Gideon's had wanted to, which was, "What? What?" she said.
"Sean wants you," he said dully, "specifically."
Nibirius had finished his length of the pool too, and had struck through the water to come and see them. His swimming shirt was a lot tighter than Coronabeth's, and his 57 abdominal muscles rippled under it importantly. He gave a long and rather obvious stretch, but stopped when he realised nobody was looking.
"What's the hold-up?" he said, rather pettishly.
"You'd better hurry up," Isaac said. "I promised I'd only leave her for 5 minutes. She's with the remains."
"Isaac, slow down." Corona had vaulted herself out of the water in a flash of warm golden skin and her exceedingly long legs, and Gideon made her first and only devout prayer to the locked tomb of thankfulness and joy. Corona wrapped herself in a white towel, still dripping feverishly.
"Who's dead? Isaac Tartarus, what does this mean?"
"It means someone's dead," Isaac said curtly.
"If you're not coming, I'm out of here in the next 10 seconds. I'm not leaving Jean by herself."
Corona dashed over to the training room, sticking her dripping head through the door. Her cavalier was wrapping his body and head in his own white towels, sticking wet feet in his shoes. Corona Beth bothered with neither of these. By now, she was being followed by Lieutenant Dias, whose only nod to training kit involved undoing the top button of her military jacket and by the scuffed wiriness of Colum the Eighth close behind. This baffled gaggle was led outside to another broad terrace, though this one had not been built with beauty in mind. They weren't far from the edge of the dock terrace. This place had possibly shared that function once. There was room for maybe one shuttle, but it was now focused on a huge steel chimney, metal flues standing up like a flagpole. It was bricked and supported all about with big stone tiles, and there were buckets of old vegetation and filthy cloths. The latter looked as though they'd been used to clean out the pool. They were emerald with verdigris and black where they weren't green. The chimney had a huge metal grate, about 2 meters tall, where you could shovel in rubbish. This grate was open, and the contents inside were still lightly smoking. Isaac came to rest in front of the incinerator, beside Jean-Marie the Fourth. He had looked stolid and dead, as though what was going on inside him had built up a thick crust, like a volcano.
Jean-Marie looked like a malfunctioning electric wire. You could practically see the sparks. Her rapier was naked, and she was pacing between the incinerator and the edge, every so often whirling around in a fit as though someone might attack her from behind. Gideon was beginning to admire her sheer animal readiness. When she saw the gang of idiots that her necromancer had brought her, she was intensely displeased.
"I wanted the Ninth and Princess Coronabeth," she said. Her voice cracked. "Everyone tagged along," said Isaac. "I didn't want to leave you. I didn't want to leave you alone."
Careless of her bare feet and her sodden clothes, Corona marched over to the first maladjusted teen.
"Sword at ease, Sir Chateau," she said kindly. "You're fine."
It was testament to Corona that the sword was lowered and slid away into the scabbard, though Jean-Marie did not take her hand off the pommel.
"What happened? What have you found?"
The fourth said bitterly.
"The body."
Everyone clustered around. With a piece of old flagstone, Jean-Marie knocked the still-smoking grate aside so that they could all peer through. Down a short shunt, embers still glowing sooty red, there was a heap of ashes. The cavalier of the second picked up an iron poker from beside the incinerator and nudged the pile. The ashes were all soft and even, crumbling to a powdery white, the red lumps breaking up under pressure. There was an expectant pause as she stuck the poker into the far corners of the big expanse and then drew it away.
"It's just ashes," said Lieutenant Dias.
"A body was burnt in there," said Jean-Marie.
Column the Eighth had gotten hold of a worn rake and was using that to pull some of the stuff closer. He stuck his hand into the boiling air and scooped out hot ashes, which showed that he either cared very little for his own pain or had a supremely good poker face. He held them out for inspection. Whatever had burnt down to a sandy grey-white stuff that left grease marks on the Eighth's yellowed palms. The necromancer teen was saying listlessly,
"I can tell fresh human remains, can't you, Princess?"
Corona hesitated. The second butted in.
"What if they were burning bones? One of the servants may have fallen apart."
"Someone could. Just go ask,"
rumbled Column the Eighth, shocking Gideon with an inherently sensible suggestion. Isaac didn't hear.
"That's rendered fat and flesh, not dry bone."
"They didn't. Are the Fifth still?"
"Magnus and Abigail are still where they ought to be," said Jean-Marie fiercely, "in the mortuary. Someone's been killed and burnt up in the incinerator."
There were long scratches down her face. She was even smudgier than her counterpart teen, if that was possible. And in that moment, she looked feral. Her curls had frizzed up into a dark brown halo, one liberally streaked with blood and something else disreputable, and her eyes were welling up from the acrid smoke. She did not look like a stable witness to anyone. Especially not to Nabirius. He crossed his arms, shivered in the morning sun, and drawled,
"These are ghost stories, doll. You're both cracking up."
"Shut it. I'm not your doll, dickhead."
"Princess, tell him. Tell him those are remains."
"Burbs, shut your mouth and fix your hair," said Corona. "Don't discount this straight off the bat."
As per usual, he looked wounded and scruffed the towel around his damp hair.
"Who's discounting?" he said. "I'm not discounting. I'm just saying there's no point. No need for all this fourth house sound and fury. Anyone goes missing, we assume they're having a nap in the incinerator."
"You are being," said the second cavalier, "surprisingly blasé."
"I hope you end up in the incinerator," said Jean-Marie. "I hope whatever killed Magnus and Abigail and whoever we just found comes after you. I'd love to see your face then. How will you look when we find you, Prince Nabirius?"
Gideon pushed between them before Nabirius could round on the ash-streaked, wet-eyed teenager. She stared into the incinerator. The cavalier of the Eighth was still poking around, and to her eye,
She had to admit there was nothing to find. Whatever had been burnt here had been burnt down to greasy, bad-smelling smithereens. Particles of ash floated up from the grate like crumbling confetti, making smuts on their faces.
"Needs a bone magician," said Colm, and dropped the rake. "I'm heading back."
Nabirius, who had been staring down Jean-Marie, was distracted by this. He was more eager and jovial when he said, "You gearing up for your duel with the Seventh? The princess and I'll rough you, naturally."
"Yes,"
said the other man without much enthusiasm.
"I'll come with. Should be interesting to see the Cav. He's not remotely like his rep, is he? Ain't ever matched him in a tournament myself."
At the exit of the 3rd and the 8th Cavaliers, the 8th looked like he wished he were deaf. The 2nd went too, more silently, and wiping her hands on her scarlet neckerchief. Only the teens, Gideon, and Corona were left. Corona Beth was staring into the steaming ashes, brief singlet and shorts whipping in the wind, fine dry curls of gold escaping from the wet mass of her hair. She looked troubled, which made Gideon sad, but she was also soaked right through to the skin, which made Gideon need a lie down.
"I keep seeing things," said the necromantic teen emptily.
They turned to look at him.
"Out of the corners of my eyes, when it's night time, I keep waking up and hearing something moving or someone standing outside our door."
He trailed off. Jean-Marie put her arm around his shoulder and pressed her sweat-streaked brown forehead to his, and both sighed defeated sighs in concert. The solace they were taking in each other was the bruising, private solace between necromancer and cavalier, and Gideon was embarrassed to be audience to it. It was only then that they seemed at all grown up to her. They looked worn down to stubs, like ground-down teeth, greyed out of their obnoxious vitality and youth. The cavalier of the 4th house looked up at Gideon and Corona.
"I wanted you to because Magnus liked you both," she said. "So you get the warning. Don't say I didn't tell you."
Then she led Isaac away, him looking like an expectant prey animal, her like dynamite, ushering him back through the salt-warped door. Gideon was left alone with Corona Beth. The princess was closing the huge grate to the incinerator and sliding the handle down to lock it. They both beheld it silently. It did seem big enough to heave a person through, down into what, when set, would have been roaring flames. Clouds passed overhead, plunging what had been dazzling brightness into relative gloom. The clouds were fat and bluish, which Gideon had learned meant that they would soon explode into rain. She could taste it on the air, washing the prickle of smoke off her tongue. When the storm broke, it would break hard.
"This isn't just 4th house theatrics," said Corona. "I don't think they're being reckless here. I think we're actually in trouble. A lot of trouble."
In the newfound dimness, Gideon took off her glasses and nodded. Her hood fell back, sliding down in heavy folds of black to her shoulders. The exquisite eyes of the necromancer of the 3rd were upon her, and the doleful expression turned into a radiant smile, violet eyes crinkling up at the corners with the hugeness of the grin.
"Why, Gideon the 9th," she exclaimed,
mourning banished.
"You're a ginger!"
The clouds broke later that afternoon. The rain beat at the windows like pellets, and the skeleton servants scurried around with buckets, catching the worst of the sleeting drips, putting matting down for the puddles. Apparently, Canaan House was so used to this that their response was automatic. Gideon was familiar with rain by now, but the first time she couldn't get over it. The constant pattering drove her mad all night, and she'd had no idea how anyone who lived in atmospheric weather could ever put up with it. Now it was only a murmurous distraction. To the noise of the storm, she had gone back to check on Harrowhark, suddenly paranoid, convinced that she had dreamt up the arms flapping out of the duvet, the short spikes of dark hair visible from under the pillow, that maybe the reverend daughter had made Gideon's youthful dreams come true by spending all night in an incinerator. But Harrow hadn't even woken up. Gideon ate lunch next to a skeleton servant, carefully balancing a bucket on the table, into which fat drips fell from the windows. Ploing, ploing, ploing. The numinous dread hadn't really left her since that morning. It was almost a relief to see the shadow of Camilla Hecht fall over her bowl of soup and bread and butter. Camilla's grey hood was wet with rain. "Jewel's off," she said by way of hello. "Seventh never turned up, and they're not in their quarters. Let's move." They moved. Gideon's heart hammered in her ears. Her rapier swung against her leg as persistently as the rain peppering the walls of Canaan House. By instinct, Gideon led them through a row of dark, dismal antechambers, door handles slippery with rain, and out into the storm itself. The conservatory, where Dulcinea liked to sit. It was stultifyingly hot and muggy in there, like walking into the jaws of a panting animal. Rain sleeted off the plecs in sky-obscuring sheets. Beyond the conservatory door, under an awning that had long since tipped into the rain, was Dulcinea. She was sprawled across the wet flagstones. Her crutches lay on either side of her, as though they had slipped from her grasp. Gideon's insides interlaced, lungs into kidneys into bowels, then rubber-banded back with a twang. It was Camilla who first dropped to her knees beside her and rolled her over on her back. A bruise popped on her temple, and her clothes had soaked right through, as though she had been lying there for hours. There was a terrible bluish tinge to her face. Dulcinea gave an enormous, tearing, terrible cough, pink spittle foaming from her mouth. Her chest jerked staccato. It was not a pretty sight, but Gideon welcomed it with open arms. "He never came back," she said hopelessly, and fainted.